didn't even invite him over to dinner, though I, of all people, know how badly he could use the break from Mother Dell's. Coming over to our apartment wouldn't even be that difficult. He could simply meet my mom at St. Elizabeth's, take the bus with her at the end of her shift. But I've never suggested it. Never even said his name. I can't. I'm too afraid any reminder of Mother Dell's will send Lola back over the edge, and, as always, I put my sister first. Now, I lift my hand in greeting. He raises his hand in reply. Neither of us makes a move to close the distance. There's family that you have, and there's family that is made. Mike Davis is my family. He saw me when no one else did. He helped me when no one else dared, and he let me go because he knew I needed to take care of my sister more than I could care about him, care about anyone. Standing across the street from him now, I bottle up all my confusion and pain and fear, and for just one moment I will myself to find anything that's bright, happy, and sparkling. I do it for the boy who still lives in the dark. For him, I imagine an electric blue ball crackling with goodwill and high energy, then I fling it across the street to him. From the girl who will never forget you, from the girl who still considers you a friend, from the girl you saved, and you should be proud of that, because now she can save her own family. All of that from me to the boy who can never stop bouncing. When I open my eyes, Mike is gone. But I like to think he understood. There's the family that you have and the family that you make. Maybe neither are perfect. But Mike and me, we've always been close enough. Chapter 37. Where is she? I was barely out the back door before Mike was in front of me, rocking up and down on his heels, drumming his fingers, clearly agitated. I went. She wasn't there. I have food, water, supplies. I'm supposed to help. Is she okay? Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? I raised a calming hand. At the last moment, I realized I probably shouldn't place it on his shoulder. He might spook and dash like a frightened colt straight into the fence. Roxy is safe, I said. Have you seen her? She can't go to Mother Dell's. Never be alone at Mother Dell's. Of course not. Mike, are you okay? He stared at me, eyes overbright. I wondered again if he was on something, or maybe off something, which in his case could be just as disruptive. I took a deep breath, willed some of my calmness into him. You're a good friend to Roxy, aren't you, Mike? For years you've been trying to help her. You knew where she was hiding out. Quick nod. Setting her up in the theater was very smart, I continued smoothly. Of course you couldn't bring her to Mother Dell's, and both of you have good reason not to trust the police. His fingers slowed slightly in their beat against the tops of his legs. Things change, though. Given everything that's happened, Roxanna needs the police on her side. She's innocent. You know that. I know that. We need the police to see that as well. He frowned, his gaze dashing around the yard, settling on anything but me. This morning I arranged for Roxy to meet with Sergeant D.D. Warren, the Boston detective in charge of the case. The sergeant is starting to believe Roxy's story. She also tested Roxy's hands for gunpowder residue. Roxy tested clean. She didn't hurt her family. Roxy would never hurt her family. What about Roberto? Would she hurt Roberto? Fingers drumming again, which didn't surprise me. After talking to the school counselor, I had some new thoughts on this subject. Mike, did you and Roxy hear what Roberto told Miss Lobdell Cass in her office that day, when Roberto was waiting to meet with the principal after having gotten into trouble for posting Roxy's photo? Did you two hear Roberto threaten her? Mike flinched. He glanced at me. Never get caught alone at Mother Dell's, he said solemnly, which I took to mean yes. That must have been very frustrating, that Roberto bullied not only kids, but grown adults as well. He bounced two times quick. Is that when you two decided something must be done? Roberto had already destroyed enough lives. 5 years later, still hurting Lola and Roxy, and now going after someone as nice as Ms. Lobdell Cass. We hated him, Mike stated abruptly. Some people are made for hating. Roberto was made for hating. Anya thinks Lola and her gang arranged for Roberto's suicide, but I spoke to them this morning. They say they didn't do it, and I believe them. It was you and Roxy, wasn't it? Roberto had to be stopped, and Ex-Lax and sleeping pills weren't going to be enough this time. Mike wouldn't look at me. He jiggled his legs, he drummed his fingers. In his own way, I thought, this was as close to a confession as we were ever going to get. "Have you seen Anya this morning?" I asked. He jerked his attention back to me. "What?" "Anya. Someone took a shot at me while I was talking to Lola's gang a few hours ago. The shooter missed. I didn't have time for a close enough look before she ran away." Mike flinched. "Maybe when you went to the theater this morning you saw Anya? Getting supplies, say, a brunette wig?" He shook his head. "Mike, Anya blames Lola and Roxy for everything. In her mind, they took the love of her life from her." Another head shake, as if trying to ward off my words. I tried again. "She's been plotting revenge ever since. She didn't love him." "Who? Anya didn't love Roberto?" "She used him. He used her. That is not love." "To be honest, for some people, it's close enough." "She has the director now. She doesn't need Roberto anymore. Just ask Lola." The way Mike said that drew me up short. "What do you mean, ask Lola?" "She knew Anya was with the director. She saw them together, in the theater. Naughty, naughty." He rocked back and forth on his heels. "I think I got it. Lola wanted revenge. She wanted to make Anya pay for everything she and Roberto had done, but Roberto was dead. So Lola went after Doug DeVries instead?" "Lola took pictures. Lola sent pictures. Friday night, Roxy found them on the computer. Lola and the fat director. Ugly photos. Disturbing." Mike frowned. "Roxy had to purge everything. She called me for help. I am good at computers. For Roxy I came. For Roxy I helped."
"But you could only clear the computer's memory, right? The pictures that were already sent. What goes out on the internet stays there."
"A concept I knew too well." He shrugged. "Roxy cried. She told Lola she was better than this. Lola told her to stop pretending. Roxy told her she couldn't keep saving her. Lola told her she didn't want to be saved. Lola left. Roxy did not talk anymore. She sat in their room. She looked so sad. Once I could help her, but not anymore. Once we could save each other." He paused, looked at me. "Not anymore." I understood. 5 years later, Roxy and Lola's world wasn't getting better, but worse. Forget Roberto and Anya and their acts of revenge. Lola had debased herself with the theater director, then distributed exploitive photos of herself on their home computer. It was one thing for Roxy to try to save her younger sister from two older, bigger bullies, but how could you save someone from herself? Then, on the heels of that thought, Lola didn't just send the pictures to Doug DeVries, did she? She also sent them to Anya. Revenge must be revenge, or it isn't sweet. Anya had implied to Dee Dee and me that she'd been with Doug during the time of the shooting, but he was hardly a reliable alibi. Given the existence of incriminating images, he'd say anything to keep Anya on his side. He needed her help for the cover-up, meaning Anya could have donned the costume of her choice from the theater, walked to the Boyd Baez house, and opened fire. Was that her real self, I wondered? The woman who'd walked from room to room, calmly eliminating her targets, until she reached the upstairs and zeroed in on her final enemy? Or had she approached the whole exercise as a role? Anya Seton playing female kick-ass assassin in this morning's performance of Vengeance Is Mine. Did either way make it any less scary? My phone rang in my pocket. I almost didn't answer it, then realized it was Sarah. I hit the accept button, placing it to my ear impatiently. "Yes, she's gone."
"What?"
"Roxana. She was here, still asleep on the sofa, when I returned with the groceries. I set out some food, then I thought I'd take a few minutes to shower, 5 at the most. When I came back out, her bag is gone, too. She took everything with her."
"Okay, contact Sergeant Warren."
"She just called. I didn't answer. I didn't know what to say."
"You might as well tell her. We're going to need her help."
"Do you know where she went? What she's doing?"
"I think so." I looked directly at Mike Davis as I spoke. "Roxy's heading back to the theater. She believes Anya murdered her family, and now Roxana is looking to even the score. Chapter 38. Dee Dee approached the community theater building, lights off. If Roxy was already there, preparing to ambush Anya, Dee Dee didn't want to spook her. Also, she had no idea about possible theater rehearsals, other people being present. The last thing she needed was a hostage situation involving the lone survivor of a family massacre and an equally vengeful target. She had issued a bolo for Anya Seton. Now, Dee Dee slowed her vehicle, driving by the front of the building while trying to search for any sign of activity. She didn't know much about the community theater. It looked like a former church, tall and plain as many of the historic houses of worship were. The white front featured chipping paint and a pair of recessed doors that formed an arch. One of the doors appeared to be cracked open. Given the bright, sunny day, it was impossible to tell if any interior lights were on. Dee Dee didn't see actors coming or going or people milling about out front, but that didn't mean anything. Chances were a building of this size could be filled with dozens of aspiring thespians, let alone two girls engaged in the final act of a 5 years running play. She turned the corner, went around the block, and immediately spied a silver Honda sedan parked down a narrow back street at the rear of the church. The plate read, "Drama." Doug DeVries's vehicle had to be. From here, she could just make out someone sitting in the driver's seat. The angle of the sun, however, blocked her view of the passenger's side, meaning Anya might or might not be in the vehicle with him. Dee Dee cruised past, eyes forward, hands flexing and unflexing on the wheel. One block up, she made a right and looped all the way around to the next block, parking one street over and up from the rear alley. She got on her phone to Phil. "At the theater, have eyes on DeVries and his vehicle." "Okay, I'm at his house with a full team. His wife is here. She said he'd gone out, but has refused to offer anything more. She's waiting on her lawyer. I need to know if there's a rehearsal scheduled for this morning." "Dee Dee, she's already requested a lawyer." I know, but requesting a schedule is hardly asking someone to risk self-incrimination. I just need to know how many people might be in a gigantic building where I may have at least one armed suspect. Tell her having a pervert husband is bad enough. Surely she doesn't want to be held accountable for a hostage situation, too. You have such a way with words." Rustling, followed by the low murmur of voices as Phil relayed her message. Then, "Rehearsal is set for this evening, but apparently the theater is pretty informal. Doesn't mean people won't come in earlier to work on set pieces, run lines, whatever. In other words, your guess is as good as mine?" "Exactly. Want me to call for backup?" "I don't know," Dee Dee said, and she meant it. In any dangerous situation, protocol demanded SWAT. And yet, two teenage girls? The mom in her wanted to believe there was a better answer to all of this, even as the cop knew kids could kill just as easily as anyone else. "Put out the call, but no one moves until I say so," she determined. In other words, plan for the worst, but don't stop hoping for the best. She ended the call, then exited her vehicle, unsnapping the holster at her waist and willing her left arm to cooperate. As Flora Dane could attest, Dee Dee could still get lucky with some one-handed shooting action, but since her injury, she didn't have the aim or accuracy she used to, and she knew it. All the more reason to take this slow and easy. She walked down the street toward the rear alley, keeping her body as close to the buildings as possible and out of sight of DeVries's silver automobile. The black bumper jutted out. She paused with her back against a storefront. Being a Sunday afternoon, most of the block appeared quiet. She eased her gun out of its holster, wrapped her right hand around the grip, followed by her left. Quick step out, glanced through the rear window, gun still held low and in front. Back seat empty, passenger seat empty, which left just DeVries, who sat still, facing forward. She dropped back, wondering if he'd seen her. Something nagged at her, the outline of his head, straight up, staring forward, same as when she'd driven by. Who sat like that anymore? Especially alone in a car. People stared down at their phones, or maybe nodded their heads along to music, but sitting so perfectly still? She got the first tickle of a bad feeling as she eased around the corner, ducked low, and raced along the side of the car to the driver's seat.
"Hands up! On the steering wheel! Keep them where I can see them!"
she barked, zeroing in on DeVries through the driver's side window. The community theater director gazed right at her, but he didn't move a muscle. Duct tape. It took her a moment to make out the silvery mess. DeVries had been wrapped with what appeared to be miles of the material. His eyes were wild above the bright gray patch stuck to his mouth, more bands of tape around his left hand to the door handle, while his right wrist was attached to the gear shift. A rush job, but an effective one, especially given the piece de resistance, which Didi was just now making out. A box cutter, taped to the bottom of the steering wheel and positioned with its blade wedged into the most sensitive part of a man's anatomy. Basically, the slightest movement on DeVries's part risked immediate castration. Knowing what she did about the man, Didi couldn't help but be impressed. She glanced around the alley. No sign of Anya Seton or Roxana Baez. Or Flora Dane, for that matter, because this certainly reminded Didi of Flora's handiwork, which maybe Flora had passed along to her newfound support group, including Roxy. "Hey, ladies, want to ensure an evil pervert doesn't bother you again?" Didi took an experimental sniff of the air. Sure enough, a whiff of pepper. Remnants of bear spray, most likely from one of the cans she'd found in Roxy's backpack. Meaning Roxana had gotten here first, then taken some time to play with the first target of her rage. And now? Didi circled the car, popped open the passenger's door, stared down at DeVries. She reached in a hand and ripped the tape from his whiskered face. The man gasped in pain. "Talk," she ordered. He did. Mike knew a side door into the theater. On the run, moving with a sense of urgency, his normally bounding gait smoothed out. His limbs and joints seemed to find themselves, working together with a kind of fluid efficiency he still couldn't master in everyday life. I was surprised by how hard I had to work to keep up, and by how ragged my breathing grew. Mike Davis had once worked in the theater, with Roxana. Set design, something like that. I had a vague memory from things Anya had said, or maybe it was from Roxy. But he definitely knew where he was going, striking a direct line from the school counselor's house to the former church. The door squeaked when he jerked it open. I winced at the noise, but he didn't seem to notice. I was trying to run a quick catalog in my mind, possible self-defense weapons, laces for my tennis shoes, a clip in my hair that happened to disguise a small razor blade, one tiny black plastic lockpick, which looked like a shortened bobby pin, but was perfect for releasing wrist restraints. Add to that some hand-to-hand combat basics, the sharp point of my elbow, the hard-edged heel of my hand, the razor jab of pointed fingers, and I had many tools at my disposal. The question was, for what? The side door led us straight to a set of steps headed down. The stairwell was narrow and dark and smelled slightly of mildew. Basement access, I realized. But I wasn't sure why we'd want to head directly into the bowels of the building, when most likely the action was happening overhead. We shuffled along in the dark. Then, abruptly, Mike drew up short, motioning for me to pause. I halted directly behind him, working on calming my breathing while straining my ears for sounds of activity. The faint murmur of voices, one high and strident, the other low and angry. Anya Seton and Roxana. Had to be. In front of me, Mike bounced soundlessly on the balls of his feet, clearly focused on the conversation, trying to make out the words. He looked up, and that's when I got it. The voices weren't coming from ahead of us, but from on top of us. Somehow, we'd worked our way under the stage. That's what the side door must be, the safety egress for the trap room under the stage decking. We eased forward. The voices grew louder, but the words were still hard to distinguish. Roxana and Anya had to be standing nearly on top of us now. Unfortunately, the acoustics of a theater were designed to project their voices out into the audience, not down into the pit. In the dark, Mike tugged at my hand, then pointed ahead. I could just make out the glowing outline of a door. He eased it open to reveal a second flight of stairs, lighter and brighter this time. They appeared to be leading behind the main stage area, where windows placed up high allowed for natural light. Better for us to see, but also better for us to be seen by. We tiptoed up cautiously, flinching at each groaning riser.
"You're insane!" I could hear Anya Seton's voice clearly now. "You and your sister both. Beneath those poor little me exteriors, you're nothing but ruthless manipulators, prepared to do anything to get what you want."
Lola was 8 years old.
Please, that girl never did anything she didn't want to, including play you like a fiddle. When are you going to wake up and smell the coffee?
She was my sister.
She killed my boyfriend, who never hurt anyone.
Now who's insane?
Lola shot Roberto in the head. She liquored him up, then took him out. And I told her as much. I let her know I was on to her.
Mike and I crept around the corner. I could just make out the back of Roxanna. She held a bright yellow aerosol can in her left hand, bear spray. What concerned me more was her right arm, extended straight in front of her, pointing a gun directly at Anya's head. Where had Roxanna gotten the gun? There hadn't been a weapon in her backpack, unless she'd stashed it in the theater, already planning to return. Anya stood 10 feet in front of Roxy. Her face was easier to see, and the blonde wasn't a pretty sight. Her eyes were bright red. Snot still streamed from her nose, gluing strands of hair to her cheeks. Compared to pepper sprays intended for self-defense, bear spray contained significantly higher levels of capsaicinoids, and Anya looked it. Most likely, Roxy had ambushed Anya with the spray in order to drag her into the theater, which would also explain Anya's hands, bound in front of her with strips of duct tape. Provide the tips, and others will use them. When I had started the support group a year ago, was this really what I'd wanted? Because this was all my advice, live and in color, playing out in front of me.
Lola didn't kill Roberto, Roxy was saying. Neither did Las Niñas. They would have said if they had. Killing him would have been their honor. Shut up, Anya spat. You just don't want to face that Roberto committed suicide, and it was your affair with Doug that drove him to it. Shut up!
Roxy didn't.
What hurts worse? That your first boyfriend died to escape you, or that your next boyfriend, a fat old theater director, preferred Lola to you. I know she sent you the pictures, and that's what drove you over the edge, isn't it? That's what made you kill my entire family.
Another low growl, then Anya suddenly lowered her head and charged. I never saw it coming. A bound woman facing down both a gun and pepper spray going on the offensive? Certainly she caught Roxanna off guard. Roxy seemed to forget she even had a gun, raising the bright yellow can of bear spray instead. But Anya had closed the distance too quickly. She rammed straight into Roxanna, arms still trapped in front of her as they both went down.
"You shot my family!" Roxy was screaming. "You murdered Roberto! You don't care, you were just using them. My sister, Manny, my mother. You bitch! How could you? How could you?"
Anya was kicking at Roxy. Then she rose halfway up and delivered a savage headbutt to the face. Roxy snapped back on the floor, clearly seeing stars. In that moment, Anya scrambled up on her knees. She spied the gun halfway across the stage and lunged for it. Just as I crossed the space and took her out in a flying tackle. The gun slid farther across the stage decking, away from both of us. I scrambled to my feet, eyes already on the target, pistol 5 feet in front of me. Which is why I was caught totally off guard by the gunshot that exploded from behind me.
Chapter 39. Fire. My arm, I could feel it burn. The bullet raking across the top of my right arm before burying itself in its intended target. Anya, now groaning on the floor. Blood. Her shoulder, my arm. I could feel myself spinning away. Shock, pain. I saw Jacob. No, the first woman. The way the blade had slid into her stomach. The look of surprise on her face. Or maybe it was the rapist. The one I doused in antifreeze and potassium permanganate before watching him burst into flames. Maybe it was me, raking my fingers in and out of the boreholes of the coffin-shaped box, watching the blood dew on my fingertips before sliding slowly down. My life, my choices, blood, pain,
The ways I had healed, the ways I was still broken, as I dug my right thumb savagely into the bandage on my left hand and used the sweet, familiar pain of the embedded sliver to ground me again.
Mike?
Roxanna said from behind me. I blinked my eyes. Turning, I took in Mike Davis, who was magically holding a gun and pointing it directly at me. No, at Anya, whimpering on the floor behind my feet. I finally got it. The skinny figure running away from the shooting this morning, the long hair peeking out from beneath the oversized hoodie. Mike Davis, wearing a wig to throw off suspicion. Mike Davis, doing everything in his power to protect his one true friend, Roxanna Baez. "You're the shooter," I heard myself say, as if making the statement would help me accept the truth. "Hector Alvalos, Las Niñas, me. You shot at me."
"Mike?"
Roxanna said again, her voice full of concern. She still held the can of bear spray, but made no move to approach. There was a look on Mike's face that worried me, too, as if he weren't entirely here, as if he'd gone someplace darker, bleaker, from which he never expected to return.
"She hurt you," he said softly. "She deserved to die."
"You shot her," Roxy said. "It's over now. Please." A squeak of hinges, then a door opened to our left. Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren appeared, stalking into the amphitheater, having no doubt heard the gunfire, and now leading with her own firearm. I didn't know if I was grateful for her presence, or even more worried about what was going to happen next.
"Flora," she greeted me tightly. "We're okay. Kind of. Mostly. I got shot in the arm. Anya has a wound to the shoulder."
On the stage floor, the girl moaned theatrically. I frowned at her. "For God's sake, the bullet lost most of its momentum striking me. Now shut up and stop reminding the guy with the loaded weapon that you're still here." Mike was still trying to figure out a shot, but right now my body blocked most of Anya's, and while he'd accidentally hit me once, he didn't seem ready to repeat the mistake. It occurred to me this was the longest I'd ever seen him stay so still. Because this was it, I realized. This moment, this conversation, this act, he considered the end. "Roberto didn't commit suicide," Dee Dee was saying now, navigating the rows of theater benches, approaching closer while keeping Mike in her line of sight.
"No, Lola didn't do it,"
Roxanna spoke up in frustration. "She didn't," Dee Dee agreed. "It was you, Mike, wasn't it? You, finally doing what had to be done to protect your friend."
"Never get caught alone at Mother Dell's,"
Mike spoke up. His tone was mournful, and his expression not just bleak. Hopeless. A boy who'd seen too much, endured too much. I recognized the look. I'd seen it so many times on my own face, day after day with Jacob Ness.
"Mike?"
Roxy asked quietly.
"You were a bright light," he said, finally glancing at her. "Such a bright light. Walking into the kitchen that first day, bright, bright, bright. I saw him see you. And then, week by week, no more bright. I knew what he would do. I tried to help. It wasn't enough, but I tried. Then you got away. Safe. Off to grow bright again. Except you came back."
He frowned.
"You shouldn't have come back. Why did you come back?"
I thought I got it. Mike had been with Roxanna in the hallway outside of Ms. Lobdell Cass's office the day of the photo incident. He'd heard Roberto threaten the school counselor, and he'd understood once again that Roberto would get away with it. 5 years later, he was still torturing Roxy and Lola, and 5 years later, the adults were still powerless to help. So Mike had taken matters into his own hands. "You took Roberto's phone," Dee Dee was saying now, her own voice carefully neutral. "Didn't you, Mike? You took his phone to protect Roxy, to get rid of the photos."
"I crushed it with a hammer, little bitty pieces, never to be put back together again."
"You killed Roberto?" Anya cried from the floor. "You did it?" But everyone ignored her. "Did you know about DeVries?" Dee Dee was asking, advancing a few more feet. "The theater director who was partnering with Roberto." For the first time, Mike appeared confused.
"Dirty Doug?
Old Mary, Dirty Doug, who always picked plays with lots of young girl actresses.
Hey, Anya, still being ignored. That would be the one. I just had the most interesting conversation with him while he was duct-taped to his car. Nice use of a box cutter, I might add. Dee Dee glanced at Roxy, who flushed. I could already picture exactly where Roxana had placed the blade. Once again, provide the tips and they will use them. According to DeVries, he spotted some of the images Roberto took of his victims at Mother Dell's. They organized a business where Roberto provided the inventory while DeVries served as distribution. Roberto actually pissed off DeVries when he posted Roxy's picture on the internet, calling unnecessary attention to their operations. DeVries was still trying to figure out what to do when you took care of the problem for him by killing off Roberto. You might have eliminated Roberto, Mike, but DeVries still has all the images. DeVries is the real problem. Mike finally looked at the detective.
Bright, 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 he said. Brightest light I'd ever seen. You still don't understand.
Then, suddenly, I did. And I think Roxy must have, too, because her free hand flew up, covering her mouth right before tears flooded her eyes. You killed Roberto to eliminate the threat to Roxy and Lola, I spoke up, because you could see what it was doing to Lola, to Roxy. But even after Roberto's death, Lola didn't settle, did she, Mike? She was still angry, out of control, and taking everything out on Roxy. It was only a matter of time before she did something really stupid, something Roxy couldn't fix, something that would hurt Roxy even more.
You loved her, Mike said to Roxy, his voice sad. But she didn't love you back. I tried to tell her to let it go, Roxy said. I tried to get her to see that when Roberto died, it was over. You bitch!
Anya again.
I wanted her to give up the gang, but she said she couldn't. They made her strong. She didn't want to be weak. She would have gotten you to join. No, never, Mike. You would have joined to save her. Roxy saves Lola. Always Roxy saves Lola. And Lola?
Roxy was crying harder now. I could tell she already knew what he would say next. In the meantime, I took advantage of Mike's distraction to shift forward. Mike, speaking quietly,
Lola never loved you. Not the way I loved you. She took. She did not give. She took. No, she was lost. She just needed a chance. You can't repair what doesn't want to be fixed.
Mike rocked up on the balls of his feet, his agitation returning. Lola seduced Doug DeVries. Dee Dee supplied now. She'd worked her way to the front of the stage area, standing merely 20 feet away, an easy shot in terms of distance. Except there were too many of us clustered together. I blocked Mike from shooting Anya, but also Dee Dee from shooting Mike, though it still felt good to have a detective at my back, especially with Anya now staggering to her feet. Then Lola sent pictures of the affair to Anya and Doug, Dee Dee continued. She wanted to hurt you, Anya, not to mention destroy Doug with evidence of him sleeping with an underage girl.
Lola wasn't going to stop, Mike said. I heard her talk. She felt on fire. She wanted the whole world to burn. She hated everyone. She hated herself, Roxy blurted out. Mike looked at her. She hated everyone, even you, especially you, because Roxy saves Lola. But you didn't.
You didn't.
Roxy, crying even harder now. What did you do, Mike? Tell me. What did you do?
Silence. Absolute silence. Which said enough.
He killed your fucking family, Anya snarled, clutching her shoulder. I knew it. I told Roberta there was something wrong with you, you fucking homicidal idiot.
I couldn't help it. I swung around and slapped Anya across the face. My shoulder flared to angry life. It was still worth it to watch her collapse in stunned silence.
You did this, I snapped at her. You and Roberto and your reign of terror. You tortured little kids. Then they grew up and decided to fight back.
Manny, Roxy was murmuring, her voice thick. My mom, Lola, Charlie. Mike, how could you? Bright, bright light, he said. You got away. You came back, and there's no brightness anymore. You love them. You give all that brightness away to a mom, One bad day from returning to the bottle, to Lola, one small push from a breakdown, to Manny, who loves but doesn't understand. So you have to protect him even more. I saw you once. I knew you once. I wish I could see you again. They were my family. And you are my family. My only family. So I protect too. I protect you. Roxy saves Lola, but I save you. By killing my entire family? Then attacking Hector and Las Niñas? By murdering Roberto? By... Roxana pointed wildly at Anya. By taking out Anya next? Mike had tracked Hector to the coffee shop that day, I realized. Maybe, like me, after hearing reports of the dogs being found there. He'd wanted revenge on the man who could have saved Roxy and Lola from foster care if only Hector had come forward at the courthouse. Just as Mike had gone after Las Niñas Diablas for luring Lola into the gang lifestyle, then pressuring Roxy to follow. So many wrongs in Roxy's life. Mike had taken it upon himself to avenge all of them, even the crimes committed by her own family.
"It's what you were going to do," Mike said now.
"No, I wasn't. This is wrong, all of this. It's wrong. We're supposed to be better than them, Mike. We're supposed to be better."
"There's no better, only weaker. I don't want to be weak anymore."
His arm was starting to tremble, the strain of holding the gun, the toll of the conversation, watching his best friend dissolve into tears. I should act. 3 quick steps, assuming he didn't pull the trigger first. I caught a movement out of the corner of my eye, Dee Dee shaking her head slightly at me, as if reading my mind. She had drifted to the right, I realized, where she now had a line of sight on Mike Davis.
"Do you know what I remember most about this place?"
Roxy said abruptly. She looked hard at her best friend, bear spray on one side, fisted hand on the other. Mike stared at her. Even Anya, sprawled with her bruised face and bloody shoulder, was fixated on her.
"I remember running the catwalk with you. On the ground, you're always so jangly, but up there... you moved so smoothly, so gracefully. You could go every place, any place. I loved racing with you around the catwalks, our own little world, where we were the ones in charge, and no one could catch us."
Mike smiled, faint, sad.
"You kissed me. Do you remember that afternoon? My first kiss. I was happy that day, Mike. You made me happy."
"My first kiss," Mike agreed.
"But we didn't do it again, because the real world still existed, and I had Lola to take care of, and we all had Anya and Roberto to survive. I carried that memory, though. Thoughts of you. So many moments with you. You made it all okay. You were the only person who tried to help me, the only person I ever... I'm sorry, Mike."
And now Roxana was crying again, head up, tears staining her cheeks.
"I'm sorry I never told you more. I'm sorry I never returned for you after my mom took us away. I'm sorry I never let you know everything you meant to me. I'm sorry. So sorry I have to do this now."
She moved. She aimed the bear spray and squeezed the nozzle, and she hit him square in the face. He didn't duck, didn't flinch, didn't reorient the gun he was holding or pull the trigger. If anything... I watched him turn into the spray of capsaicin, open his mouth, take it all in, drawing the pepper spray deep into his lungs. The next moment I was racing toward the choking, stinging cloud. "Call 911!" I yelled. "Call 911!" Then I was shoving Mike out of the noxious fumes, trying to roll him into cleaner air, as his face turned bright red, his eyes swelled shut, and his lips turned ominously blue. All the strength of the pepper spray straight into the lungs? Mike started to gasp, then convulse, his heart already fluttering like a trapped bird against his ribcage as I searched for a pulse. Roxana Baez lowered the can. She stood alone as Dee Dee jumped up onto the stage and joined me in starting CPR.
"Fucking losers," Anya Seton said.
Too late, I realized she'd crawled across the stage and now had her hands on Roxy's original firearm. Anya raised her bound arms triumphantly, pointed the gun straight at Roxy. We were too far away. Nothing we could do. Anya pulled the trigger. Click. Anya frowned. Pulled the trigger again. Click, click, click.
"It's a prop gun,"
Roxy said simply, as Anya hurled the weapon across the stage, then sat back on her heels with a howl of frustration. Mike and I worked with them before as part of set detail. I knew where the good one was kept, the nearly perfect-looking model used for show nights. She stared at Anya. I just wanted to scare you into talking, to finally confess, on the record, everything you'd done. Roxy motioned vaguely to the side of the stage, where I now saw her phone recording away. You and Roberto always got away with it. You didn't just bully the kids into silence, but the adults as well. This time, I wanted it to be different. I thought you'd killed my family, and I was going to make you admit to every single gruesome detail. Then I was going to give the recording to my friend Mike, who would take it to the police. He would finally feel vindicated, too. Roxy glanced down at her gasping friend. Her next words sounded far away. Besides, Flora told me to stay away from real guns. She said it took courage to pull the trigger, and not everyone could do it. She told me I was safer to stick to products I understood, like pepper spray. She taught me that with the simplest things I could be dangerous enough. She gazed at Mike, whose eyes had now swollen shut, whose arms and limbs convulsed against the floor. I am dangerous enough, she said. Then she wrapped her arms tightly around her waist and wept. Chapter 40 Flora Dane was right, Dee Dee thought. She should surrender her detective's shield and turn vigilante just to avoid doing any more paperwork. In the days following the showdown at the theater, it felt like she was drowning in reports. Evidence lists of all the items seized from Doug DeVries's house, computers, cameras, and yes, caches of digital photos featuring underage girls. Some Doug had apparently taken himself at the theater, but many more had clearly been provided by Roberto Phelan, as various rooms in Mother Dell's house appeared in the background. DeVries had been taken into custody, his wife as well, once they'd determined she'd not only been handling the financial end of operations, but skimming off her husband's ill-gotten gains in order to set up an offshore account of her own. According to Mrs. DeVries, it was only a matter of time before her cheating husband ran away with one of his starlets. No way was she going to be left with nothing. Mother Dell swore up and down she'd never seen the photos before, had no idea Roberto had taken any, let alone been selling them to some pervert at the community theater. The fraud squad turned her books upside down and sideways without finding any evidence of financial gain. But the real truth, in Dee Dee's mind, came from watching the woman view the photos for the first time. Her face had paled. Her three chins had quivered. She was horrified. She was heartbroken. And, if Dee Dee wasn't mistaken, she was traumatized by being presented with images too close to a personal history the woman would never tell. Mother Dell was put on probation, her waivers rescinded, several children, plus the babies, removed. She had two foster kids now, younger boys who got along. They didn't seem to know what to do with entire bedrooms to themselves, and meals that now involved meat and fresh fruit and vegetables. Maybe this would help them. Maybe Mother Dell would do better. But Dee Dee couldn't help thinking of the kids who'd been taken away to be placed... where? The system remained overstretched. Today's solution, merely tomorrow's problem. Anya Seton had received medical treatment for her shoulder. The gunshot wound had not been severe. She'd been in and out of the ER in a matter of hours. Dee Dee had dragged her down to HQ for several more days of questioning. But in the end, they couldn't prove Anya knew that Roberto was wheeling and dealing in pornographic photos, particularly given that Mike Davis had smashed Roberto's phone, destroying a key piece of evidence. Dee Dee was also willing to bet Anya had helped herself to Roberto's share of the illicit photo profits after his death, but they couldn't find any trail of funds. Most likely Roberto had dealt in cash, which Anya had then converted into headshots, acting lessons, wardrobe, whatever it took to advance her future Broadway career. After much consideration, Didi charged the girl with attempted murder of Roxana Baez. Law was based on mens rea, meaning what mattered was the intent to commit a crime. So, while the gun might have turned out to be a prop gun, Anya hadn't known that when she'd pulled the trigger. Her intent in that moment had been to shoot Roxy Baez. The lack of a real handgun had merely thwarted her best efforts. Didi felt good about the charge, though in reality, given that Anya had been attacked and forcibly restrained by Roxy in the moments leading up to the would-be shooting, a good public defender would argue self-defense and most likely get Anya cleared on all counts. Basically, the only thing they could definitively prove was that the girl was a bitch. Sadly, that was not an offense punishable by law, so Didi had no choice but to file what charges she could file, then move on. Roxana was a tougher case. She had not murdered her family, or shot at Hector Alvalos or Las Niñas Diablas. In the end, they even found video of Roxy buying the red scarf, as she had claimed, in the minutes after Hector went down. But she did assault Mike Davis, Doug DeVries, and Anya Seton with bear spray, which, as the warning on all the aerosol cans clearly stated, was a criminal offense in the state of Massachusetts. While the acts against Doug DeVries and Anya Seton could be minimized as first-time incidents, Mike Davis had died from the assault, warranting serious consideration. Self-defense was one of those gray areas of the law. Did Roxana Baez have compelling reason to believe her life was in imminent jeopardy? Mike Davis had been pointing the gun for a good 10 minutes without pulling the trigger. Then again, he'd used that time to confess to the murder of 4 other people. Of course, his self-proclaimed target was Anya, not Roxy, but he'd been looking straight at Roxy, not Anya, by the end, meaning Roxana could have believed herself in harm's way. This is where paperwork mattered. A savvy detective writing up her report, while also including a corroborating witness statement from her new CI. As she explained to Alex that night, Jack finally tucked into bed, Kiko dancing at their feet in the backyard. You know when policing drifts into murky terrain? There's what happened in the eyes of the law, and yet what matters for the sake of justice? Alex nodded, hefted back his arm, let the tennis ball fly. He threw like a major league pitcher. Didi was already jealous. So, Flora Dane and I are 2 very different people. And yet, just today, we managed to deliver 2 accounts of the events leading up to Mike Davis's death, prepared individually and independently, which both included all the right words to help the ADA reach the same conclusion. Roxana Baez was acting to save her own life when firing the pepper spray. In fact, Mike Davis had thrown himself into the stream of chemicals, deliberately inhaling the capsaicin into his lungs to increase the damage. A version of suicide by cop, Alex murmured. Kiko was already back. This time Didi got the ball. She did her best. Sad, she commented now. He was just a kid, not to mention as much a victim as Roxy and Lola in all of this. I think he really did believe he was doing what had to be done to save Roxy. That her family, far from being a support to her, was more like an anchor dragging her down. Tough. Yeah. And too harsh. Because Juanita Baez might have made her mistakes, but she really was on the right track, and she was fighting for her girls. Had she gotten a little further with her own investigations, maybe her lawyer would have been able to put together a case, and real justice would have been served. Kids don't think of adults that way, Alex said, especially not teenagers. Kiko whined. Alex got busy. Shooting Roberto, Didi listed off, then murdering Roxy's entire family before going after Hector, who'd once abandoned her, and taking on Las Niñas Diablas, who'd threatened her. So many wrongs done in the name of right. Poor kid. Mother Dell volunteered to pay for his funeral. Alex slid her a look. Least the woman could do. Exactly. And Roxy? He asked. Kiko was back. Didi's turn again. She didn't have her husband's arm, but she did have her son's enthusiasm. Who could have known this was exactly what she'd needed? Alex, Jack, and now the best spotted dog in all the land. Roxy has moved in with Hector, believe it or not. I think they'll help each other heal. And she does still have Flora and Sarah. I'm not sure what I think of this merry band of survivors. And yet, after everything Roxy has been through, I'm grateful she has that kind of support. Certainly I can't imagine being in her shoes right now and facing everything alone. So Flora Dane really is useful? On occasion, Dee Dee granted. And Phil and Neil? They'll come around, she stated, not convincingly. Alex grinned at her. Just what you need, a little more chaos in your life. Actually, she said, as Kiko once again returned with her prize, I think I'm handling this chaos just fine. And working with a vigilante won't rub off on you at all? Wouldn't you like to know? Dee Dee winked at her husband, then launched another tennis ball into the air. I found Sarah almost exactly where I expected to, standing inside the historic college square, staring straight ahead at some gothic monstrosity that must have cost a fortune to build in its day and had lasted the centuries since. Wearing a brown leather jacket, Sarah had her arms wrapped tight around her waist and was eyeing the collection of buildings with grim determination. "I'm going to do it," she said when I walked up, never taking her gaze off the college hall. "Okay. It's like getting back on the horse, right? Everyone's got to do it sometime." "If you say so." "Besides, it's not like I was attacked on campus. There's nothing in these classrooms, the library, that should trigger me. Cramped apartments, sure. Roommates, fine. But I have my own studio place now. Not exactly close to here, but that's okay. Long bus rides, tea transfers are a small price to pay for peace of mind." "I would keep your apartment," I agreed. "It's your safe zone." Then I added, "For now." She finally looked at me. "Do you think I can do this?" "I think you're not the person I met a year ago. I think you've already proven you can do most anything." Her face collapsed a little, her eyes growing a sheen. "Flora, I'm scared." "I know. I've been standing here 30 minutes already. One step, then another. I need to take them, and yet..." "It's okay to be scared, Sarah. You, of all people, know how scary the world really is." "What if I do it?" she said abruptly. "And it's not so hard. I graduate, I get a job, I fall in love, I'm happy. What then?" "Then I think your roommates will be very proud of you." She started crying, silent tears rolling down her face. "I'm scared," she said again. "I know." "Why haven't you done it? Gone back to school? Something?" "I am doing something." I shrugged, tugged her hand away from her waist till I was holding it. "I'm doing this. Maybe it's not for everyone, but it works for me. Besides, I'll have you know I'm now a bona fide member of law enforcement, a confidential informant for the esteemed Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren, no less." Sarah rolled her eyes at me. "Seriously?" "Seriously. I like it. It's another way to help. It's another way... to not be locked in a coffin-sized box all alone anymore." I didn't say those words out loud, but Sarah nodded as if she understood. One survivor to another? I bet she did. "Show me your hands," she ordered. I dropped my grip on hers long enough to hold out both palms. "You're not wearing a bandage anymore." "I'm taking some steps of my own." She regarded me somberly. "If I do this, move forward, we won't see each other so often." "I'll be your friend for as long as you'd like," I said, but I knew what she meant. Our relationship was more teacher to student, me showing the ropes of the whole survival business, her learning how to thrive again, which, if she continued on this path, would be mission accomplished. "Know this. I'll be the one cheering the loudest at your graduation." More tears. I started to feel my own eyes well, which surprised me. 472 days later, I often felt I had no tears left. And yet this emotion didn't feel so bad. It felt right. Pride in my friend and her own bravery, and a job well done.
Roxy?
She asked now. Sadly, our group never runs out of members.
But you'll be there for her.
A statement, not a question. You will too.
I'll do my best, but you know, going back to school...
Roxy will be okay. You've been there. You know what it's like. She's not magically going to feel better today or tomorrow, but day after day after day. Before we know it, she'll be standing on a college campus of her own. She's too bright, too determined to do any less.
Sarah took a deep breath. She held out her hand on her own now.
I smiled, took it, gave it a squeeze.
Together? She asked.
Absolutely. On the count of three. One, two. I tugged her forward before she expected it, catching her off balance and forcing her to advance. She laughed, a little breathlessly, and just like that, we were crossing the college green. I thought again of that first night, the scared young woman standing in her apartment, covered in sweat, armed with bear spray, that wild look in her eyes. And I saw Sarah now, composed, chin up, as she strode forward. Here was the truth of my life. If Jacob Ness had never kidnapped me, I would never have known what it was like to be starved and terrified and abused and isolated. Yet, if Jacob Ness had never grabbed me, I would never have had this moment either, helping this person and having this day when all felt right. Was it enough? A gain worth the price? Or did it matter? Because the price had already been paid. At least I'd been able to find this path, make this life from the ruins. And maybe that was the best any of us could do.
Thank you, Flora,
Sarah was saying. I shook my head. No.
Thank you.
Epilogue.
Name, Roxana Baez. Grade 11, teacher, Mrs. Chula. Category, personal narrative. What is the perfect family? Part 8, final installment. This is my family. I had a mom, Juanita Baez. When I was first born, I was all she had. No husband, no boyfriend to write in the birth certificate, just her and me. I like to think she held me close. I like to think she loved me very much. And the first time she heard me cry, she promised me the world, the stars, and the moon at night. I know later she would break that promise. But I know after that she did everything in her power to make it right, and that's love, yes? Not being perfect, but working hard to fix your mistakes. I had a mom, Juanita Baez, and she loved me. I had a sister, Lola Baez. I was 3 years old when she was born. I remember my mother bringing her home from the hospital and letting me hold her on the sofa. I remember thinking she was the most beautiful baby I'd ever seen, and I promised her then, from the bottom of my 3-year-old heart, that I would give her the world, the stars, and the moon at night. I worked hard to keep that promise, but like my mom, I made some mistakes. And my beautiful little sister, she made some mistakes of her own. She chose to fall when she could have chosen to rise. She chose hate when she could have chosen love. She chose not to believe in our family at all, but to take up with some gang in our place. But when violence came into our home, when she knew what was going to happen next, she also chose to take our little brother into her arms. She held him close. She tucked his face against her chest so he would not have to see his own death. In that instant, she chose our family again. And she was the sister and daughter we all knew she could be. And that's love, yes? Not making all the right decisions all the time, but being there when it matters the most. I had a sister, Lola Baez, and I know she loved me. I had a brother, Manny Baez. I was 7 years old when my mother brought him home, and I was already scared for him. My mother liked to drink a lot by then. Her new boyfriend, Hector, drank as well. I took care of my little sister, and now I would have this baby, too. But the first time Manny gripped my finger with his tiny hand and looked at me with those dark eyes, I knew I would love him forever, and I promised him the world, the stars, the moon at night. In return, Manny offered smiles and laughs and pure joy from the bottom of his little boy heart. He was the light of our lives, and nothing that happened next ever dimmed the strength of his devotion to us. And that's love, yes? To give generously, selflessly, endlessly. Manny didn't have to learn any lessons during his 9 years with us. He was our teacher instead. A reminder of what the rest of us could achieve if only we could open up.